are building a path for the peace paradigm. King and Gandhi, many more, have discovered something core. Now we're building a path for the peace paradigm. Every challenge is another highway sign on the path of the peace paradigm. Ooh, 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 ooh.
Welcome, friends, to another episode of Peace Paradigm Radio, radio that explores the power of nonviolence in all its forms, from theory to practice, and nonviolence in the news. I'm your host, Stephanie Van Hook, and I'm here in the studio with my co-host, Michael Negler, and we are from the Meta Center for Nonviolence. Today is September 16th, 2016, and on our show, we'll be talking with Chief Phil Lane, a traditionally recognized hereditary chief and elder from the Inhanktuan Dakota and Chickasaw Nations. He's a dual citizen of the U.S. and Canada and a frequent speaker on Indigenous rights and wisdom because of what we're seeing happening in Standing Rock. So with that said, I'm going to turn now to Michael Negler, my co-host, who's going to conduct the interview.
Thank you, Stephanie. And Chief Phil Lane, I'm so glad to have you with us.
Brother, I'm really very, very pleased to be here as well.
Thank you. I'm going to call you Brother Phil, but you're known to the world as Chief Phil Lane Jr. And you have two tribal affiliations and belong to two nations.
Yes. I'm an enrolled member of the Yankton Sioux Tribe, as well as the Chickasaw Nation of Oklahoma.
I see. So you are directly involved with what's going on at Standing Rock. Is that not so?
Well, you know, it's quite a moving experience for me because my father was born at Wakpala, which is just to the south of Cannonball.
I see.
And as well, I have a lot of blood relatives there at Cannonball. And I think in order to really understand what's happening at Cannonball, or what's happening at the Sacred Stone Camp, it's important to understand the foundation of this, the history of what's happened.
Please fill us in. Yeah.
Yeah. So, as you know, the Great Sioux Nation has seven council fires. And they speak with a D and an L and an N. That's the only difference between them. And it's very significant to what's actually happening there right now. On September 3rd, 1863, very near to Cannonball, at a place called White Stone Hill, there was 4,000 Ihonkane and Hunkpapas camping there, completing their preparation of food and all that needed to happen to go into a really, really strong Dakota wintertime, which is very, very strong in terms of the extreme cold, blizzards, etc. And they were very peaceful. Just prior to that, up into Minnesota, there had been the Minnesota Sioux Uprising, some people call it. Really, it was about the fact that these relatives there had been, their treaties had been violated so many times, and the food they were promised had never arrived. They were starving. They felt completely violated, and five young men were out hunting, and one young man killed some of the settlers there. There was five they killed. And then they decided they would, the only way they could get through this, since nobody would listen to them, is they began to attack these various settlements. And, of course, it was over very quickly because of the incredible power of the U.S. military. And at the order of Abraham Lincoln, the largest mass hanging ever to occur happened on that 26th of December 1862, where you had 38 men hung at one time. It's really quite amazing to see the picture of these 38 men hanging there. But the remarkable thing was that the eyewitness accounts said that each of these men, before they were to be hung, shook hands with all the jailers, all the people there to hang them, and were very respectful. And they had their spiritual leader speak and said, you know, we're looking forward, be strong, we're going to a better place, we'll see you there, a much better place than this. And they were just so courteous and so respectful. And then, of course, they took them up and hung them all at once. So this General Alfred Sully, following that, was out to use as an excuse to really attack any Dakota, Lakota, Nakota he could find. Now, you know, where this happened, down close to Cannonball, this is a long ways from where these other incidents happened up in Minnesota. And so they, when they started coming to the camp, the Etanches, the chiefs, put up a white flag of surrender. They had no desire to fight or anything like that. They were there with their families and, you know, drying meat and so forth. And, of course, General Sully just disregarded that flag of peace and came in and literally just massacred up to about 350 men, women, and children, took another 150 prisoners to Fort Randall. Now, that's where the Yankton Sioux Reservation is. That's where I'm enrolled. And others fled. And part of the 4,000 fled into the Standing Rock. Now, Standing Rock, by the way, was part of a great, 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 great Sioux Nation treaty of Fort Laramie, which was, it included the Black Hills and much, much more territory that was illegally taken. In fact, the Supreme Court said the theft of the Black Hills was the most dire, dark, legal thing ever been done in the history of the United States. So what happened after that is, and they actually had somebody there, you know, they were really into measuring the destruction they were able to wreak on their attacks. They measured the dried buffalo meat, had just been dried. There was 500,000 pounds of buffalo meat. And so they took all the belongings of the people, all their tents, all their buffalo robes. They even went so far as to take and drive bayonets or drive knives through the bottom of any cooking pots they had so they couldn't cook in them. And they burned them, everything. Took them 2 days. They said the fat, the tallow coming out of that 500,000 pounds of buffalo meat was so great that it was like a river. Now, these is from the military accounts. It was so massive, it was like a river coming into the valley. So that was August 3rd, 1863. It was that very day, August 3rd, 2016, and I happened to be first in that morning at Greengrass, and we were getting prayers there with our white buffalo cap pipe. And the great leader there, our great spiritual leader and chief Orville Looking Horse, his beloved wife Paula, in the morning. By the time we got down to Standing Rock, of course, that's when the first violent action took place against these peaceful protesters, where this private security group, who I understand was connected to other kinds of actions in Iraq and Afghanistan, particularly Iraq, turned these dogs and pepper spray on all the protectors who had come up there, because this is on a Saturday now. This is Labor Day weekend. On a Friday, the Standing Rock Sioux tribe entered into the federal court a description of all the different burial sites, the sacred sites of the Strongheart Society, all these sacred places. And, of course, immediately, the next day, without any notice, the Dakota Access Pipeline began to bulldoze that entire area. I mean, it's just like, you know, on a Saturday morning, waking up and all of a sudden, here's somebody with a bulldozer after you let them know that your cemetery's there in your home community, bulldozing down over your cemetery and your church and everything else. Well, of course, about 100 or 200 of the members of the camp, especially younger people, went up there peacefully. They had no weapons. They never have had weapons in that camp, even though they've been accused of having pipe bombs and weapons and so forth. And, of course, that's when you saw that Amy Goodman program and others. But Amy Goodman was right there, and they then turned the dogs on them. And they bit, you know, a pregnant woman, a little girl, and about five or six people. And they maced maybe even another 14 or so before they fled. And the reason they fled was the dogs started biting their handlers. And so they took off. Now, it's interesting. The state of South Dakota actually has charged criminally Amy Goodwin for trespassing, a number of other things, and as well as others for just being there reporting this.
So, Chief Phil, you know, it occurs to me that maybe not all of our listeners will know what the Dakota Access Pipeline is about, and that's one of the key issues. Could you fill us in a little bit on what's actually happening there?
There was discovered, and they called them the Balkan oil fields, up in the northwest corner of South Dakota, of North Dakota. They're fracking up there. They're getting a lot of oil out of there. Huge oil boom started up there, and so they wanted to take that oil and build this pipeline to take it through four states. It's only about 15 miles, I understand, shorter than the Keystone XL, which would have brought, tar sands oil down into the United States across and through both in Canada and the United States, sacred lands. So this pipeline not only runs through the Dakotas, but also into Iowa, on to two more states. And of course, with the American citizens who don't have treaty rights, they're simply just utilizing eminent domain and just taking their land. Pathway, and there's a number of federal laws, and people need to understand, that protect. I mean, literally federal laws that protect sacred sites, that protect what they're trying to defend. So that's the Balkan oil fields pipeline moving from the northwest corner of North Dakota down through four states, moving it to where it can be processed.
Thank you very much.
Interesting thing. One thing I want to add. I mean, we're talking about big players behind this. Toronto Dominion Bank here in Canada. You go back and look behind this, you see tremendous numbers of banks and financial institutions that are very well known to both Canadian and American public that are backing this. And what happened? This is another strange thing. The original route took this pipeline right by Bismarck, instead of coming down where it goes across to Missouri, right there where Standing Rock is. And the people of Bismarck, the mayor and everyone, made such a cry about the fact they're going to bring that pipeline by them. That's where they sent it down where it is now.
I say thank you, Brother Phil. That is, boy, it's really a story that's unfolding there. And I know that you have just been there. And I wonder if you could give us a feeling for the spirit of the people who are calling themselves protectors instead of protesters.
Yes, absolutely.
Go ahead.
Absolutely. And I'm sharing this because of the fact that it was Chantewash Day, Walter Strongheart, from right up very close to that community in Wakpala that gave me my first name when I was just a little boy of 12. And then it was Frank White Buffalo Man from another place called Little Eagle. Because up above where the Sacred Stone Camp and Cannonball are the Hunkpapas. So there's what they call Chain Buttes. This goes up to Mobridge. On one side of Chain Buttes, you have the people of Gaul, PZ. Those are all those Hunkpapas that fought against General Custer. On the other side of those buttes are the Hunkpapas also, but the people of Sitting Bull, Tatanka Yotanka. So then you come to the north, and here is Cannonball. And so when we came there, we were on this totem pole journey that started in Vancouver, went down to Seattle, through Longview, Washington, across Washington State, through Idaho, and stopping along the way at various places for prayers, then across Montana, stopped at Custer Battlefield, and then came on to, they changed our itinerary to meet up with all these delegations coming from the Northwest. Now, that was incredibly impressive, because if we go back to 1969, 1970, when you had the Wounded Knee occupation, or Wounded Knee, what do people call it? This is when the American Indian Movement went in, and there's reasons why they felt that that was theirs to come to. And you had that big arm standoff for a long time. And the difference between that and what I witnessed at Standing Rock is this was not, quote-unquote, activists who were opposed greatly by tribes, even on the Pine Ridge. Of course, there's a big battle going on. A lot of people lost their lives between the tribal council versus, quote-unquote, the activists. Now, as a result of that, at the same time, I want to mention that because of this action, you might say it's kind of almost like a good cop, bad cop deal, where that because of their action, the government then went closer to the tribes in terms of kind of, you might say, joining them in opposition to the American Indian Movement. So there was good things. There were one there, although obviously the violence did not work. You know, this idea of using weapons didn't work, and it ended up, of course, in the imprisonment of Leonard Peltier ever since that. Now, the difference that I witnessed as we came in there, and we purposely arrived at the same time as the Lummi Nation came, because they were sponsoring this Lummi Nation totem pole journey led by this master carver, Jewel James, who was just really quite an incredible spiritual human being. And so when we got there, we had a meeting, and here were all these, the president of the National Congress of American Indians. He's also the chairperson of the Swinomish tribe. There was the tribal chair and vice chair of the Lummi Nation, representatives from all these different nations. The Yakima Nation sent this incredible delegation, practically their whole tribal council, all in their traditional headdresses and traditional clothes, traditional clothing. You had others coming from the East Coast, West Coast, all over coming. So we first stopped at the Tribal Center at Fort Yates. And, of course, the thing to remember is that, you know, it's our tradition that we honor and feed anybody that comes on our territories. So all these delegations are being met by the tribal council and chairperson of the Standing Rock Sioux tribe in their tribal chambers. And so here was this incredible, you might say, coming together, which is unprecedented. This has never happened. The Yakimas have never come as a nation as they've come, or all these other nations have never done this. It's just never happened. They may have had meetings where everybody's there, but in terms of actually joining in an action about sacred sites, about sovereignty, about water, which is the core of this whole thing, protecting the water, it's never happened before, ever.
Brother Phil.
That we there was a large caravan. They had caravan. They had a couple of their own tribal police with their, you know, their lights going on top and so forth. And we followed them. I was in a car right there, and then behind us a totem pole and all these other cars. We got to the camp, and it was amazing entering that camp because people were just, you know, using, you know, certain cries that are made of welcome, and, you know, putting their hands up and saluting everybody. And so we stopped just before we entered the camp, and all the Yakimas came in all their headdresses and so forth, and everybody, a whole group in front of the car I was in, and then the podium pole behind us, and walked into the camp. Boy, what an experience. It was something to see all those relatives come and greet us. And then, of course, the presentations and talks by each of the tribal leaders, and they each brought their flags to fly. So at this point, if you were to drive in there, you would see almost like even four flags of the United Nations. On both sides of the road coming in, there's flag flying from all these nations, all these groups that have supported Standing Rock. And what I found was truly peaceful camp. I mean, I think the feeling there, it's almost a huge healing process occurring. And tribes who never, ever had been together in this manner before were there. But we're talking about, you know, most people don't realize it, but there was very little conflict prior to the coming of others to the Americas between indigenous nations. Because everybody had their own space. There was, you know, horse stealing raids and other kinds of more minor conflicts up to the north, but there was very little loss of life. I mean, people always say, "Oh, well, you killed each other," but it wasn't until the predestined arrival of our European tribes coming in, and particularly from all sides, so to speak, and pushing over. One tribe against the other, one nation against the other. Of course, what happened was, especially during the English and French wars, they would have some on either side, make them a lot of promises, give them weapons, and then they would push further. So you got to know that there was conflict that was happened between the Pawnees and the Lakotas and Dakotas and Nakotas, and there was other conflicts that went on between other groups. But all of a sudden, everybody was together, like one heart, one mind, many bodies. And really, every morning, spiritual ceremonies for peace, and ceremonies and songs throughout the day into the nighttime. People were visiting and renewing relationships. So we're talking about an incredible cauldron, almost, of a cauldron of spiritual healing going on. I don't know if that's a spiritual fire that's burning in these camps. And I have to say the Standing Rock Tribal Council, and you know, I've kept up pretty closely because I'm going to be going back there on the 2nd of October. With representing the United Religions Initiative, which I'm a global trustee, which we have cooperation circles now in 97 countries, as well as representing and other tribes we work with in Panama and other places to bring a flag and to bring greetings. So anyway, so to understand this peaceful side of things, and how that's working out, and how the state of North Dakota and now the National Guard is operating on that. They were going to have, which they did, a very peaceful prayer ceremony at the North Dakota State Capitol in Bismarck. And the person handling the liaison with the Morton County Sheriff, he thought everything was just fine, John Eagle Sr., And what happens is somebody overhears, this is the lack of cultural understanding, overhears somebody say to somebody, "Please remember to bring your pipe," which means your sacred pipe, to pray with. The next thing you know, here's the Morton county sheriff coming out and saying, these, they're armed and they have pipe bombs. And we've heard shots going off in the camp, which is completely untrue. And, of course, when you see the actual pictures of video of what happened, after that ceremony, it had all these police there. After, and before you know it, they had the actual, some of the police, North Dakota State Patrol, dancing in the round dance with the relatives doing the ceremony. And afterwards, they went and shook hands, the whole line of every person that was there, all the people from different indigenous tribes, all went and shook the hands of the police officers. They shook their hands.
Brother Phil, that is absolutely wonderful. You are listening to Chief Phil Lane on Peace Paradigm Radio. We're going to take a brief break now and listen to a song that's relevant to Standing Rock, but I'm going to ask you, Brother Phil, if you would stay on, because I have some more questions, and it's fascinating to hear your report.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Respect the honor. Listen close, my friend. This is happening. Warrior. Drink the water. Seven generations are the sons and daughters. Gather all your friends. This is happening. Warrior. Thank you.
listening to Peace Paradigm Radio, and we're talking with Brother Chief Phil Lane, who has just come back from Standing Rock, and he is talking to Michael Negler, my co-host.
Thank you, Stephanie. Brother Phil, you were giving us a beautiful description of the spirit that you saw at Cannonball and at Standing Rock. And as I'm listening to you, I'm getting a very strong impression that three things are happening at once, and I'd love you to comment on it. One, there's a coming together of indigenous people such as is unprecedented. It's never happened before. It's up and down the Americas, everybody at Turtle Island. Right. Two, there's a resurgence of traditional ways, including even clothing. And this, much of the activity at Standing Rock, I know, has revolved around prayer and ceremony. And thirdly, there's a nonviolence that has come about there. And all those three things seem to me to be related. Could you comment on that, Brother Phil?
Sure, sure. And I think it's really in this whole thing, the spirit of unprecedented unified action being generated at Standing Rock is reverberating literally around the world. I mean, there was relatives from Ecuador who came all the way up to bring their greetings, which is a fulfillment, further fulfillment of the prophecy of the reunion of the condor, the Quetzal, and the eagle, which is unfolding across the hemisphere, across the Americas. This is happening. There are relatives who came from Hawaii that are protecting this mountain there. They came and were present and brought their traditions. The Maoris from New Zealand have been. This support of indigenous people is global. In South Africa, I talked there with yesterday, on some developments we're working on there. There, everybody's aware of this. So the unprecedented unified action, these prayers and ceremonies, that, by the way, have been going on forever. I mean, they never stopped. They might have had to take a different form because they were forbidden until 1977, when they passed the Freedom of Indian Religion Act in Congress. The first time, legally, you could do pray as an indigenous person in the United States. I mean, that was against the law. And so there was a period of time in which indigenous people everywhere, the only way they could pray, the only way they could worship was in various Christian churches. Now, by the way, I have to really distinguish at this point between churchianity and Christianity. I think they're two different things. And what I've seen done in the name of Christianity is absolutely not Christianity. To me, I'd simply call it churchianity. Like Jesus said, he said, you know, if anybody does things in my name, cursed be they. This, what's been done in the name of Christianity is not, certainly not Christianity. It's something extremely sick. Anyway, so you have literally this huge spiritual fire that's been lit at Standing Rock, and it's spreading. And by the way, these prophecies, there's many, many across the Americas that for 48 years I've been doing my best to seek out and put together and to go to all these different places as well as other places around the world to see how they all fit together. They all say the same thing. That, you know, there would be this long spiritual winter time of 500 years. And it would really be tough winter. Really tough. But at the end of that 500 years, a new great spiritual springtime would emerge everywhere on Mother Earth. Now, when we go into our sun dances or our sweat lodges or go up to fast for 4 days and four nights with no food or water, or a sun dance, or whatever. There's many ceremonies, just like I guess it would be Lent in a Christian perspective. We have, and some of these ceremonies, you really sacrifice and you really have to pray. But after those 4 days of no food and water, or those 4 days of sun dancing in 100 degrees weather with no food or water, and when you leave that, you're a different person. Because you've held on to that which is sacred, you continue to pray. In a way, I believe what we've been through is a 500-year Sundance, a 500-year Inikakas, Sweat Lodge, and whatever other ceremonies around the world has been done. And so, really, this spiritual movement, this spiritual giant is awakening, is a spiritual giant that's much greater than it's ever been seen, ever, in history. In recorded history, there's never been something like this. But it was all promised and prophesied. And we, another time we can get into those prophecies. So one of the things, and by the way, I just want to share this, that what is behind the scenes is the fact that the Standing Rock Sioux tribe, who young people, the Standing Rock Sioux Youth Council, they ran all the way from Standing Rock to Washington, D.C., ran all that way to try to bring this message to President Obama. They weren't received at the White House. And they are not a wealthy tribe. You know, they have probably maybe 70-80% employment. And yet they're providing support for an average of 3,000 people a day, I'll say over a 7-day period. Maybe there's 5,000, drops to 2,000. I'd say the average is around, now at this point, about 3,000 people a day. Just alone, that cost, if you just figure $20 a person to eat all their food, that's $42,000 a day. And then when you add in porta potties at $1,500 a day, trash pickup at $500 a day. And I went over this all with some money we pledged to bring to them. It's about $50,000 a day to maintain that camp, and nobody's turned away. So anybody who comes in that camp, any member of the human family comes in, they get fed. They have a place to sleep. They get water. The sanitation is taken care of. And so that's why I wanted to say that I think it's very important, if anybody wants to contribute and support this, the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe is the place to put any donations. They're the ones behind the scenes that are doing everything. Their young people started this, and I appreciate all these other efforts that are wanting to receive monies from this. But the ones that are really behind it, and the ones who are going to have to take care of the aftermath and the camp, when the winter hits, it's going to be the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe.
Brother Phil, I donated this morning through a website. I wonder if you could give us the simplest way that people can make a donation to the Standing Rock.
The simplest way is simply go on the internet to the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe. And on the website of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe, right in the top, on the left-hand side, you'll see a contribution to the stopping the Dakota Access Pipeline. You can donate in various ways there. That's the best way. If you want to donate another way, I suggest you get a hold of the Tribal Council Office, the Office of the Chairperson, Chairman Dave Archambault. Get a hold of his office and say, you know, I have a donation to make that doesn't fit into this other guidelines, and give it that way. But that's where I would direct it. I think, and by the way, it's not that the other camps aren't doing things, but the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe is the one that's supporting all the camps in terms of the porta potties, in terms of security. They have 12 of their staff that should be doing something else that are there 12 hours a day backing this up. And so there's, you know, we have to walk the spiritual path with practical feet. And so that's what people aren't seeing, is it's incredible. And all this is volunteer. I mean, all these cooks have come in. And I have to say, the backbone of that camp are women and grandmothers. They're the backbone of this. They're the ones that are making sure people are fed and taken care of and giving guidance and so forth. And you know, I really want to recognize that, because the Dakota teachings tell us that the wings of the eagle are two. One is men and one is women. Until both wings of the eagle, sacred eagle of humanity, have equal power, respect, and honor, the sacred eagle of humanity will never fly its highest.
Beautifully put, Brother Phil. And I wonder if at this point I could even read a statement that from David Archambault, who is the chairman of the Standing Rock Tribe. It's a beautiful statement. As American citizens, he says, we all have a responsibility to speak for a vision of the future that is safe and productive for our grandchildren. We are a peaceful people, and our tribal council is committed to nonviolence. It is our constitutional right to express our views and take this stand at the Cannonball Camp. We are also a resilient people who have survived unspeakable hardships in the past, so we know what is at stake now. As our songs and prayers echo across the prairie, we need the public to see that in standing up for our rights, we do so on behalf of the millions of Americans who will be affected by this pipeline.
Yes. Very, very wonderful.
Well, Brother Phil, as I'm listening to this fascinating report that you're giving us from the, as I'm listening to it from the standpoint of nonviolence, I was struck by the damage that was done by rumors, because that's one of the main things that trained interveners do all around the world, is they go in and do what's called rumor abatement. They, for example, Search for Common Ground has trained 32 journalists to go into conflict areas all around the world and report the facts and quell the rumors, because those rumors are what can lead to these flashes of violence. But let me ask you this question. As I'm listening to, for example, Candy Mossett, the Navajo spokeswoman who spoke so beautifully on Bioneer's website the other day, it seems to me that there is a dimension of nonviolence that I haven't quite heard yet. Now, she said that they are not against the workers, that they feel that the workers in these pipeline companies, these 5,000 employees, are being abused almost as much as they themselves are. So they want to join forces with them, and there's a beautiful tradition for that in nonviolence. But what I'm seeing is, how can I put this? People are getting very flustered and agitated and start yelling back when they're attacked. Now, this is 100% normal human activity. But in one of the Navajo women who was begging people not to be violent, she said the reason not to be violent is that that's what they're waiting for. That's the chance they're waiting. Now, I agree with that 100%. It's absolutely correct. But I wonder, have you heard echoes perhaps of a deeper dimension where people might say, we're not going to be violent because that's not who we are?
Absolutely. You know, the first day I was there at the camp, because of the fact that my great-grandfather was kind of a primary spiritual leader of the Standing Rock for 40 years, literally. And in fact, he has his statue in the High Cathedral in Washington, D.C., the National Cathedral, for his incredible, he's among what they call the saints of the ages there in the National Cathedral, where all the presidents are buried and different ceremonies are held. He's at the third statue from the right on the right-hand side. You know, this. First of all, the word Dakota or Lakota, Dakota means the friendly people. The friendly people. And, you know, there's been different models that have come in from the outside about, you know, what direct action is and so forth and so on. But what I'm hearing from the very depth of the spiritual leadership, and in fact, when I came to the camp the first day, I was doing something else, and I heard my name being called, and I was invited to speak, cut a copy off guard. And afterwards, Dave Archambault's father, a chairperson of Archambault, who's a really incredible gentleman, I've known him for many, many years, he asked me, he said, you know, Phil really would like you to share tomorrow about this whole idea. And so I shared, and I really talked about how, you know, don't allow them to provoke you. Don't allow them to take you away from your peaceful center. Because they'll do that. They want to have us violent. They want us to get angry. That's part of the, they want to divide and conquer. I mean, that's a process. I mean, it's been done all over the world. I'm not saying, by the way, every human being has a colonial mindset of divide and conquer other human beings. And so these ceremonies are all about prayer and about peace. And the question I've been asking, do we have to get arrested in order to, in the long run, to win this spiritual struggle. Now, I have to really put a caveat in there because, you know, when you see the numbers of indigenous people in this hemisphere, just in Brazil last year, 48 killed. 48 indigenous people killed for trying to stand up for their natural environment. I mean, this is not a very pretty picture here. My sense is that this was the greatest challenge Crazy Horse had, was this very thing in terms of, and a whole different age, different time, but they realized early on that this whole thing we used to do is count coup. That means the idea wasn't to kill your energy enemy. It was used to coup stick to touch them. If you touched them, then you bettered them. And so there was very little bloodshed, really, during those days. You'd count coup. Well, when they encountered the military, you even see in the museums, the coup sticks get longer because the military have bayonets. But then they realized that who they were dealing with, they were there to kill men, women, and children. I mean, they realized that they had to completely change the whole way they did things. So at that point in our history, as Dakota people, the mothers raised their sons to die, literally, to protect the land. And that's why you see this statement, it's a good day to die. Because that's how precious the land and the buffalo and the water and their lifestyle was. And of course, they went as far as they could with that. And finally, with the massacre at Wounded Knee and then later the assassination of Sitting Bull, Crazy Horse had already been assassinated. By the way, held his arms held by his own people when they did that. They continued to pray. So my sense is this, that this process, you've realized all these things I'm telling you, just that White Stone Hill massacre, there's many more of those stories, that there's a lot of discussion going on about this right now. And at the heart of this thing is a spiritual understanding that we're one human family. And that once you realize and truly in that consciousness of as being a one human family, then you understand the hurt of one is the hurt of all and the honor of one is the honor of all. Once you understand that, then you realize that we have to get rid of every form of prejudice, anything that makes us feel better than or less than another human being. So at the core of these ceremonies, at the core is the understanding that we are one human family. Everything is interrelated to everything else. That's why at the end of a prayer, people will say, "Oh, Mitakiyasi." We're all related. Everything's related. Mineral, plant, animal, human. We're all related. And I see that. That's emerging. We're in a process here, not an event. This is a process. And I'm getting ready to write a piece I've been really praying about this, beyond Standing Rock. What's going to happen here? Well, first of all, we know, my dad always told me, that there's the tides come in and out. So it goes in, and then it comes back. You might say to gather itself, and it comes back in. Sometimes it really comes strongly. And so right now, you have all these relatives, all this unprecedented coming together. Now, coming up here in a short time, you're going to have a blizzard hit. It'll get cold, start getting cold, wind, cold. And I mean to say, anybody in the Midwest knows how cold, or been back there during a wintertime, how cold it gets. Or up in Canada, northern Canada. I've been clear up in Nunavut, up in the eastern Arctic. It gets cold. And wind chills up to maybe 60 below zero. And some are already beginning to dig in. But I think that what's going to happen here, this is what I see. There is Wounded Knee. I mean, there are Standing Rocks everywhere on the Mother Earth. They're getting prepared to arise everywhere. Talk to relatives down in Irvine. They're getting ready to bury a bunch of radioactive things down there in sand along the beach. And you're seeing everywhere, this last raping of Mother Earth's going on. And so all these things that we're learning about nonviolence, what we learn from experiences of Gandhi and what happened to Gandhi, and what he shared. But now we're at a different, I think a whole different new, it's like almost like you can see a spiral going up, up to the heavens. And that's carrying on an ever-advancing civilization. And so we're now at this point where people are resonating all over Mother Earth about what's happening at Standing Rock, but really what's being prepared is an incredible wave that's come in to Standing Rock, spiritual wave, I see it. Whoa, it's powerful. And that wave, when that winter starts coming in, it's going to go way out all over the world. And all of a sudden, the Keystone X, I mean, the Kinder Morgan pipeline here is supposed to be approved in December by the Canadian government. I guarantee you there'll be another Standing Rock right here on the Burrard Inlet. There'll be others that'll happen because you see people all over the world expressing concern. Once they get back and the people are prepared to light the fire there, we're going to see a huge global transformation around the fact that we cannot allow what's happening to our Mother Earth to happen anymore. At the same time, we know if it's not a peaceful process, and in some places there'll be lives lost simply because the people we're dealing with, the relatives we're dealing with, are very, very spiritually sick. They've gotten so caught up in the materialistic world and so caught up with their greed and other kinds of things, they'll just about do anything to get what they want. And when they see this whole system based in the nothing but science and the physical crumbling as it is right now in every area, globally, the economic system, political systems, and so on, when they see this, you know, the most dangerous time to deal with an animal is when they're dying. You know, you have to be really careful because in that death throes, they are really vicious. And that's where we have to be more peaceful. We cannot allow ourselves to be provoked. And they will do whatever is necessary to provoke you into violence. So that is happening. The young people are learning that. We're learning that to balance that. It's just it's a process, not an event. But it has the future is this. All the prophecies promise that through this process we're in right now, that we will emerge into a whole new global civilization. Now, this is not this thing about people are talking about, oh, this secret order where these, you know, everybody's enslaved. No, this is based in the oneness of humanity. It's based in justice for every human being. That every human being has a right to clean water. Every human being has a right to a good education. Every human being has these. And we have to balance the extremes of wealth and poverty. That's going to happen.
Brother Phil, I just can't thank you enough for the insight and the wisdom and the inspiration. Thank you so much for sharing that all with us.
Thank you so much.
And we're going to continue this conversation. I'm happy to say that on Tuesday, there were more than 200 actions that were organized in just a few days in support of Standing Rock, and that was among non-Native populations.
Absolutely. We are one human family.
Brother Phil, thank you so very much, and we will talk to you again later, I hope.
Yes, absolutely.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for the good work you're doing.
Thank you, Stephanie.
For those of you who have been listening to this program, you are on Peace Paradigm Radio, and we've been talking with Brother Phil Lane Jr., a traditionally recognized hereditary chief and elder, and speaks often on Indigenous rights and wisdom, talking to us about the Standing Rock protectors and the work that's going on right now in nonviolence in our world. And it's very inspiring, and he gave us lots of insights and things that we can do. So thank you so much again. So we want to thank our mother station, especially KWMR, for making this show possible, and to the underwriters that support this local station, and to all of our listeners and the staff and friends of the Meta Center for Nonviolence. Thank you very much to all the protectors in the world, and as well as the musicians, including musicians who helped make this show possible today, including Lloyd Ferris and Trevor Hall. You heard music on the show. Until the next time, everybody, take care of one another.